The final character I wanted to mention is Gouverneur Morris. Is a wonderful character, big strapping guy. He had a peg leg, which from a carriage accident, he'd lost the bottom half part of one leg. And all of it, he was a raconteur, a very convivial guy, much admired by the ladies. And all of his contemporaries liked to say that he had lost his, the carriage accident had happened as he fled a jealous husband after vaulting out a bedroom window. The official story is that that is not the case, although we all still like the story. A Frenchman in Philadelphia in the 1780s wrote of Morris that he possesses the most spirit and nerve amongst those I met at Philadelphia, but his superiority, which he has taken no pains to conceal, will prevent his ever occupying an important place. It could be a little hard to take. He spoke more than anybody at the convention, and he wasn't there for 3 weeks, which gives you a flavor for how much he would hop up and speak. But he did two great things there, which really need to be remembered. One is he gave the first abolitionist speech in American history. The three-fifths rule deal was cut when he was out of not in town. He came back, obviously didn't like it. He started picking at it and poking at it. I gotta believe off camera in the taverns and the inns where they stayed and ate and the parties they went to, that he was tugging on their whiskers about slavery, and other Northerners were as well. And he finally got up and denounced slavery as the curse of heaven. It is a speech that I can still read after a dozen readings and still feel a tingle over. One other delegate supported him, but by standing up the way he did, he changed the dynamic of the convention, and after a couple of days, suddenly there were slave state delegates who were standing up denouncing the slave trade. Now, that was an easier political target. You weren't taking people's money away from them, you were just saying you couldn't have more slaves. And that became a huge issue, which ultimately was resolved in another compromise. The Southerners threatened to walk out. Pretty much somebody threatened to walk out every couple of weeks. But the Southerners threatened to walk out. And then there is a moment when you can see Rutledge and the Pinckneys, who are other, there were two Charles Pinckneys there, which is always confusing. The South Carolina delegates, you can see they're suddenly feeling that the world is changing and the sand is shifting beneath their feet. And they say, well, maybe we should have a committee to talk about this. They adopted the committee structure as a way to resolve the tough issues. And they did set up a committee to deal with the slavery issue. They dealt with it in a way that is hard to admire. The New England delegates actually traded away slavery in return for greater authority over interstate trade and in foreign commerce. There had been a provision that it required a two-thirds vote in order to approve trade legislation. They got that taken out so it would be simple majority. And in return, they allowed the slave trade to continue for 20 more years. It was guaranteed. But after 20 years, Congress did ban the slave trade. And it was the beginning, at least, of our struggle with the issue. Some of you may have seen the recent movie Amazing Grace, which talks about the British fight over the slave trade. And it is striking that they finally banned the slave trade in 1807, and we banned it in 1808. We had a chance to do it in 1787, and we whiffed, and that's a shame, too. I don't want to, I have a tendency, and I'll confess to it freely, to tell stories and get carried away here, and I don't want to do that too much. I did want to talk for a minute about the committees that they used. They found that the large group, the 35 or 40, 45 people who were present, and they never had more than that at any one time, was not a good way to resolve tough issues. And they formed what were known as often as committees of 11, which were one delegate from each state. And it's a great frustration that we don't know exactly how they chose them. We know that it was the one time the delegates didn't vote as states, they voted as individuals. But we don't know, did they come up with slates, or did each delegation put forward the person they wanted on that committee, and there's just no record of that. But the first committee of 11 dealt with this confrontation between the large states and the small states. It's a great sort of object lesson in the wisdom that comes with age, and at least came with Ben Franklin's age. He was on that committee, and they met on the hottest day of the year. We know that day was hot. It was July 3rd, right before the July 4th holiday, and July 4th was a big deal for these people. And they argued all day over this, and at the very end of the day, Franklin said, why don't we do it this way? And he proposed really what we have now, which is we'd have one house of Congress where states would have equal votes, that's the Senate, one house with Democratic votes, and the lower house, the elected by popular vote, would have the power to create money bills, the tax and appropriation bills. That was to be a SOP for the large states. It has turned out not to be very significant. And everybody in the committee thought it was a lousy idea. And they all said, well, we're tired, so we'll bring that back to the convention. So they brought it back to the convention, and in the convention, everybody thought it was a lousy idea. The large state people hated it. They had had a situation with popular representation in both houses of Congress, and they were losing it. Small state people still thought they were going to be enslaved to large states. The level of rhetoric, and you know, it's something that I do try to keep in mind. We worry about the quality of rhetoric in our political life. It wasn't better then. You know, one of the small state delegates, this fellow Gunning Bedford of Delaware, got up and he was so angry, he clearly just lost it. He said, you know, I don't trust you people from the large states. You would crush us. In fact, what we're going to have to do in the small states is we're going to have to make alliances with foreign nations in order to resist you. Well, that's treason. And it was an electrifying moment. Luckily, it was a Saturday afternoon, and they had a day to sort of cool things off. But that was just how passionate they got. And Franklin's compromise, which nobody liked, ended up holding. And it did prevail. They kept using the committee structure. Ultimately, my favorite committee was in August. They come back. They've got Rutledge's draft in front of them. Still a tremendous number of issues. And every time they get a tough issue, and frankly, it seemed to me always, every time Governor Morris stood up and wanted to talk again, they'd say, well, let's pass this. Let's postpone the issue. And they'd move on to the next one. And so they finished at the end of August. They'd gotten through everything, but they had this big stack of issues that they postponed. So they created a committee of the postponed parts. And that committee had to deal with, how do we choose the president? What powers does this president have? A tremendous number of difficult issues. What do we do with Indian tribes? And they did a relatively good job with that. One of the real failures, in my view, of the convention, and I say this, I don't mean this to be a terribly negative experience. They were dealing with such difficult issues, the most difficult issues we have. How do we live together? How do we live together in peace? How do we share the power of a large group of people? How do we protect people from each other? But in choosing the president, they came up with a system that didn't work. It didn't work the first time we had a contested election in 1796. You had Adams win, and his opponent became vice president. The second time we did it in 1800, it didn't work very well. We had a tie between two people on the same side. It went into the House of Representatives. They thought that would be good. Actually, George Mason had said that 19 out of 20 elections will be resolved in the House of Representatives, and that'll be fine. In the event, it turned out to be a bad arrangement. It took 35 votes in order to come up with a winner. It was a real constitutional crisis, and so the worst elements of their system were corrected by the 12th Amendment, which was adopted in 1803. And of course, they forgot a Bill of Rights. It's not exactly right to say they forgot it. They made a conscious decision not to include one. At the very end of the convention, two of the leading delegates, George Mason of Virginia and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, were both known to be thinking about not signing. They'd been very deeply involved in the debates. They'd been very creatively involved, but there were parts they just didn't like. And so about 4 days from the end, and I can never keep track of who was first, but one of them stood up and said, you know, it would be, if someone were to propose a Bill of Rights, I would second that motion. And the other one stands up and says, I propose a Bill of Rights. And the first guy got up and said, I second that. And they argued that, you know, it would be very easy to write a Bill of Rights. We had state models to draw from. And they were really shouted down, I think in large part because it was viewed as a stall, which it might have been. The delegates really thought they were creating a structure of a government and weren't concerned about rights. It was a blunder, frankly. As soon as the Constitution was released to the public in late September, they discovered that this was a huge controversy, and all of the people who had argued in the convention, and their arguments in the convention against Mason and Gerry were really sort of lame. They said, well, you know, if we start listing the rights, what if we leave one out? Everybody will think that's not protected. We don't want to do that. They said, well, the state constitutions have bills of rights and they'll protect you, which, you know, was just wrong. I mean, they'd written the Supremacy Clause. They knew that wasn't true. But it wasn't. It was a situation where it didn't matter what the tenor of the debate was. It was simply too late. It wasn't going to happen. But they got into the ratifying conventions in the states, and they were forced to say, gee, we really do need a Bill of Rights. That's a great idea. And promised that as soon as Congress were convened that they would address that. And they did. And many states, when they ratified, actually appended lists of rights that they wanted to have protected. A couple of things just to close with, and I hope to take some questions. I feel very strongly that, and I mentioned at the beginning about the parts of the Constitution that the signers, the big shots, didn't like. I love the quote from Governor Morris many years later when he was admitting that he wrote the Constitution. I not only took it as a man does his wife for better or for worse, but what few men do with their wives, I took it knowing all its bad qualities. Madison was in despair over the absence of a veto over state laws. He thought state legislatures were the instruments of the devil. They were creating all these terrible laws, and Congress needed to have a power to veto those laws. His colleagues thought that was nuts. One fellow said, you know, are we to approve every bridge in North Carolina? This is not sensible. And he lost the issue three times. He kept bringing it up. And he wrote a despairing letter to Jefferson afterwards. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. We don't have this critical thing. But he supported the Constitution, of course. James Wilson hated having each state cast that equal vote in the Senate. He thought it was far too aristocratic. Alexander Hamilton thought the Senate was nowhere near aristocratic enough. He thought they should have life terms. He thought the president should have a life term. Ben Franklin thought there should only be one house of legislature. He thought there should be three presidents. That way, none would have any power. And he thought public officials should not be paid. It only corrupts them. Rutledge and the Southerners hated giving Congress the power over navigation laws, as they called trade laws. Governor Morris was terribly upset about the slave trade. But they did all sign. And I think they expressed a political culture, helped to build a political culture, and one that that every generation needs to develop and renew, that it is more important that there be a constitution than that there be any particular element in it. Some of the compromises were ugly, but that was the only way they were going to get it done. In many ways, the most important thing said at the convention was by George Mason, and it's the only thing I quote twice in the book, so you won't miss it, which is, this Constitution will be defective. Therefore, it is very important that we make it possible to be amended. And it's not easy to amend the Constitution, but it can be amended. The Articles of Confederation, it was impossible. You needed a unanimous vote of all 13 states, and they could never get it. But when you think of the amendments we've had, the Bill of Rights, the 14th Amendment, the ending of slavery, woman's suffrage, these were essential amendments that needed to change the nature of our political relationships. And without them, we would not, I think, have the same government. And I think it's important for us all to understand that the Constitution is ours to make of what we wish. And if there are parts of it that don't work, we should remember that Mason said it's defective. And we have their approval in trying to change it and make it better. Thank you.